Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
There are some issues that get us talking. None seem to be as effective as the difference between the biological sexes. When it comes to how we fight infectious diseases, you definitely had a lot of questions. And I'm happy to say that Eileen Scully is back with us. She's an assistant professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. And she also published a paper to explain the possible consequences of COVID-19 infection based on biological sex. I'm Jason the Germ Guy Tetro, and this is the Super Awesome Science Show SAS class on COVID-19 and biological sex. Last week, I suggested you give Eileen Scully's paper a read, and it seems like some of you actually did. Thank you. It also looks like many of you went into different directions regarding the effect of biological sex and infections. And then, there was one question that seemed to dominate them all, even though it had nothing to do with the current pandemic. Now, before we get to that question, if you haven't listened to last week's episode, I would suggest you go back now and do so before we get into the others. The information Eileen shared was not just important in relation to COVID-19, but also in terms of how we live from day to day. Class is now in session. Here's your first and most popular question. Is the man cold, or man flu if you're British, an actual thing?
So I'm going to take a really controversial stance here and say yes. So I do think that it is possible that men experience certain infections with more symptoms than women. Even as I say this, I'm imagining all the people who will be angry at me. And no, it is not the same as childbirth. But I do think, you know, there's some data to suggest that the cytokine responses, acute inflammatory responses, are not the same. And so it would follow that the experience of that inflammation would not be the same. Having never been a man, I can't confirm.
Fair enough. Now, last week you mentioned that there was a difference with cardiovascular diseases, and we've had a few questions about other chronic conditions, specifically obesity and diabetes. Do we see the same type of difference between the biological sexes?
So I'll talk first about obesity, because this one is one that I find fascinating. So I remember as a medical student, when you look at a CT scan, if you're not told whether it's a male or a female, and you're not shown the parts that would give that answer away, you can often tell by the fat distribution, because there's an increased prevalence of subcutaneous fat among females and an increased prevalence of visceral fat among males. And so what that means is the subcutaneous fat is sort of the fat that goes right under the skin but stays away from the organs. And then the visceral fat is the fat that's sort of wrapping around the organs on the inside. And there's now some data to suggest that that actually is fundamentally different kinds of fat. And so even when you have reached obesity, there are potentially different consequences for females versus males, partially due to how inflammatory that fat is, and partially potentially due to the immune consequences of that fat. So I think more will be revealed about the impact of obesity and the intersection with sex. For diabetes, less clear. I think, you know, there is an overlap certainly between some being at risk for being overweight and having type 2 diabetes, less so for type 1 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease that emerges in childhood for most individuals, and so that is less susceptible to some of the hormone-based effects of sex differences, and actually doesn't show the same type of female enrichment that autoimmune diseases like lupus show. So from both the type 2 diabetes standpoint and the type 1 diabetes standpoint, I would sort of hedge and say that there's not as clear differences between the sexes, although there are clear differences in the complications associated with that, including your risk of cardiovascular disease, which remains elevated among men.
And since you brought it up with respect to women and their choice of foods and how that differs from men, Is it true the freshman 15 is a reality?
So I can only speak to the COVID-19, which is the 19 pounds that some of us have gained by being confined to our houses. But no, I mean, I think there are clear differences in metabolism between males and females. And again, part of this is based on the evolutionary demands. So during pregnancy, women are required to retain and use calories in a different way than men's bodies are ever expected to do. And some of those calorie conservation and or slowing of metabolism in the setting of food deprivation are present throughout all of life with variations according to hormonal cycle. Some of that's driven by appetite stimulation, some of that's driven by metabolism rates, but we're clearly not the same.
We're going to go back to COVID for a second here. And do you believe that we could have a change in the way that we treat individual COVID cases based solely on biological sex?
So this is something I'm actively working on right now with some of our clinical data here from Johns Hopkins, and then also in the lab looking at gene expression profiles, and just trying to see if we can get to a place where we can better risk stratify. We currently have treatments that we try to deploy based on disease severity, but that's based on a global disease severity. And if we can be more refined about it, so defining a risk for severe disease in men versus a risk for severe disease in women, potentially we could deploy treatment in a little bit more targeted and effective manner, avoiding some of the risk of side effects and still getting the benefit. So I do think it's possible that we could have a risk stratification. And you know, it's not unheard of, like for the cardiovascular risk calculators, whether or not you're a male or female is included as part of that risk calculation. In something like SARS-CoV-2 infection, where we have seen a clear difference in male versus female outcomes, it would make sense, actually, that you would include sex and gender in your risk calculation for assessing the probability of an outcome.
This question, I think, is fascinating. I don't know if you would have an answer or not, but I really want to ask it. Do you think we can identify the difference between a genetic difference between the sexes and a hormonal one by looking at children as opposed to adults and sort of stratify them that way?
In SARS-CoV-2, we have a very unique situation, which is that children are not like adults in ways that are a little bit unexpected. Usually when you see risks at extremes of age, that includes both extremes of age. And in this case, it does not seem to. And some of the explanations about more frequent exposure to other coronaviruses and potential cross-protective immunity may be possible, but they don't really account for all of the differences, to my mind, that we've seen in terms of risk of severe disease. I think another population in whom that research is entirely possible is among transgender individuals, so people who are living in a gender that is not concordant with their sex chromosomes, and often who are on hormonal therapy to affirm their gender identity. And with an epidemic like this that's infecting millions of people, there are plenty of people that we can learn from and we can understand it. And that again becomes important because, as you know, we now live in a world where people are able to express their true gender identities, and physicians sit across the room from people of all identities. So if we're going to counsel patients about their risk, if we're going to make decisions, understanding which of those factors are related to hormones and which of those factors are related to chromosomes becomes actually clinically important.
And I guess the next question sort of relates to that, just on the other side of the age spectrum. What about people who are going through menopause and andropause?
Yeah, so great questions. And I think, you know, as I've been poring over the data here, it's also intersected with just questions of longevity itself. So we know that there is a female longevity advantage, that life expectancy is usually longer for females than for males. And so then the question becomes, at what point do you tick over into being someone who has a longevity advantage? At which point it may wash out some of the other risks? And so thinking about whether there's a young old and an older old, because, you know, at some point it says something about you and your health status that you're able to survive to a certain age. And so whether or not you then show the additional impact of a protective or increased risk factor of some other contributor is more difficult to assess.
The next question relates to what you said at the very beginning of last week's episode, and that has to do with the idea of gender identity and fluidity. Is there room for these individuals within clinical trials, or much like we've seen with people, you know, who have allergies or who have pre-existing conditions, they kind of have to wait before they can have any kind of treatment or even selected for a vaccine? It is an important question, and I don't know if you have the answer, but I think we should be talking about more often.
Yeah, I agree. I'm always a huge advocate for inclusion. So I think we underestimate the prevalence of people with this type of condition in our lives. Men with prostate cancer are often on androgen deprivation therapy. Women who've experienced breast cancer may or may not be on estrogen blockade for several years after an initial diagnosis and treatment, in addition to the community of people who are living with trans identities and may or may not have additional hormonal supplemental therapy. So I think with something like COVID, which has spared no one, there is certainly the opportunity for high quality research to be done as long as it's collaboratory across different groups. You know, it's unlikely that in your one single institution, you can gather a large enough sample size to look at these questions. But with more advanced collaboration across institutions, I think we can really answer some of these questions. And sort of goes back to that point I was making last week, that this global tragedy, like, we have to find the things that we can take out of it. And one of the things we can take out of it is massive opportunity to understand more about infection pathogenesis. And that includes understanding more about it in populations that are rarely involved in studies.
I find that if someone happens to be excluded from treatment or vaccine or any kind of trials to be able to improve upon an infectious disease or even a chronic disease, that they themselves may feel out of place and go towards what we like to call intentional unsafe behavior. I mean, we have seen this to some extent with COVID-19. It was very, very prominent in HIV. Is this more than just simply a reduction of selection bias? This really comes down to just overall human respect by including them.
I absolutely think so. But I also would be very clear that trust is not assumed, and we can't expect all communities to immediately engage in research, especially those that have had experienced things that through the medical system or through their lives that would suggest that they won't be treated with respect or equally. And so I think one of the reasons why I always try to say yes whenever anyone asks me to talk about science is that I think that communication is a critical part of our jobs. And recently in my clinic, I've been discussing with my patients the potential availability of a COVID vaccine. And I have to be honest, every single one of them has expressed concern and expressed that they don't want to be among the earliest ones to receive it. And many of them are in a vulnerable population of people with immune compromise and in racial and ethnic groups that have not done well in the United States and would be on the top of the list. And I found that the most persuasive thing that I can offer is that I won't recommend anything that I won't do myself, that probably healthcare workers will be receiving it first, and I will do that. And I will, you know, in that view it as a duty to be able to report back to my patients and to build trust. And so I think that in addition to learning about all these different populations, we have to do outreach and establish communication and trust so that people feel comfortable and safe and will come to receive care that we can offer and will understand the motivations for the research that we're doing.
And finally, we know that this is a very, very dense topic. There's so much to know, and we've only barely touched the surface in this conversation over the last 2 weeks. Where can people go to learn more about the differences in immunity between men and women?
So there's a really great website, the Office for Research on Women's Health, that has a link to lots of different resources on sex differences and gender differences and infection risks. In Canada, there's an office for understanding the impact of sex and gender on health outcomes. And then there's the Global 50-50 website, which looks at sex and gender differences in COVID outcomes. And then also there's an international collaboratory project looking at the impact of sex and gender in the COVID pandemic.
And there you have it. I want to thank everyone who asked a question, and I do hope that you gained some further insight into the differences between XX and XY. If you didn't hear your question, make sure to let me know by tweeting me at JA Tetro or sending me an email at thegermguy@gmail.com. And if you do want to leave me a voice message, just head over to speakpipe.com/sass. That's SASS. I always love hearing from you. Next week, we're going to be talking about COVID-19 and the cardiovascular system. This has become one of the most important concerns of the pandemic, and I guarantee you will want to hear this. And that's why it's best to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And while you're there, don't forget to rate and review us. It really does help spread the word and get more people to find the podcast. We're proudly part of the Curious Cast family and are available at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and everywhere you get your streaming audio. You can also listen at curiouscast.ca. And be sure to check out the show notes for more information about what you heard today and links to Eileen Scully. The award-winning Super Awesome Science Show is written and hosted by me, Jason Tetro. Dila Velasquez is our story producer, and sound design and final production is by Greg Schott. Have a great week, stay safe, and as always, make sure to show them some sass.